This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Audio Book Club. My name is Katie Waldman. I am a staff writer at Slate, and I'm joined today in the DC studio by the writer and critic Jacob Brogan.
Hi, Katie.
Jacob is the host of our podcast Working, so check him out there. And all the way from Paris, France, we are also joined by the Audiobook Club's founder, another writer and critic, Megan O'Rourke. Hi, Megan. Nice to talk to you again.
Hi. So good to be here with you virtually.
Today, we're going to be talking about Too Much and Not the Mood, a collection of lyrical essays by Durga Chubose. It is her debut book, although she has made a name for herself as an internet writer, a writer of internet essays. And just want to say up front that our next selection for July will be Miley Molloy's Do Not Become Alarmed. Okay. Too Much and Not the Mood. I have a sense from talking to both of you a little bit before we started recording that you have strong feelings about this. Jacob, will you share just one strong feeling?
I think that to me, the best way I can describe reading this book is that it's a little like opening oysters in search of pearls. You don't always find a pearl, but there's still this wonderful, strange meat inside, and you have the strange sense that it might go well with a gin cocktail. I don't know. For the most part, I found it delightful and engaging, and even when it was frustrating, exciting.
Yeah. Do you feel like you have a strong sense of who this writer is?
That's a good question, because there's a sort of structurally evasive quality to her style of writing. We learn a lot about her, but we're not always getting her. And that, when I said that sometimes frustrating, it's you want more. You want the clearer contours of the person sometimes. But it's the things that crop up on the margins of her prose, of her paragraphs, of the essays. It's not the full figures, but the shadows that you see flitting across the edges of the room that I found most engaging and sometimes most beautiful here.
Yeah. I mean, maybe we should back up and try to shade in a little bit of what we do know about this writer. So she talks about being the child of first-generation immigrants from India, and they become separated, I think, when she is...
Her parents separate.
Yeah, her parents separate. How old is she when she's a preteen, or maybe an adolescent?
12, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And we hear about her sort of turbulent 20s in New York City. We hear about sort of her sense of being on the periphery of her own life just because she's used to inhabiting white spaces. Mm. And she talks about the sort of ongoing process of clocking her brownness, which
was
an interesting...
bring up that phrase.
Yeah, an interesting way to put it. It's not that her brownness, as she describes it, didn't play a role in her life, but she only recently has sort of been bringing her consciousness to bear on the role it played. Mm-hmm. And I gotta say, like, it is kind of – that's a sparse amount of detail, given that this book is It is 221 pages long, and I'm sure I'm obviously leaving out a lot of biographical information, but we don't learn a whole lot about her from a sort of I guess in comparison to a lot of memoirs.
We've seen a lot of criticism recently of the whole category of the so-called personal essay, and in many ways this book and the pieces that make it up, many of which originally showed up on sites like BuzzFeed and elsewhere on the internet, is a product of the personal essay boom of the last decade. But in other ways, it's very much a flirtation with something more like the impersonal essay, where the personal is present more as a ghost than a determining factor.
Yeah, Megan, I want to bring you in.
A couple of things. Really interesting. Well, first of all, I'm sort of laughing inwardly at Jacob, you describing the boom of the personal essay of the last decade. And I know there were a bunch of pieces recently about this, but I'm laughing because when I began working in publishing as an editorial assistant at The New Yorker, it was like this endless series of pieces about the boom of the autobiographical, the age of the memoir. And it kind of feels to me that like every decade has proclaimed itself like the decade of the, this is the apogee of the personal and the memoir ever since then. So, you know, there's, I think, a kind of historical context here of this ongoing, autobiographical writing. But there's certainly something particular that's been happening with the internet, with young writers, so-called millennials, and the internet and places like BuzzFeed. So as Katie knows, I have some strong feelings about this book, which are mixed. As I've thought about it more, they're more mixed than at first I was having a lot of difficulty accepting this book. But here's what I would say. What I found very appealing about this book and what has really, to my interest, really sat with me and kind of, opened up inside me is there's something quite eccentric about it, right? There's something, and it has to do with what you two are talking about in terms of like the sparseness of autobiographical detail. Because on the one hand, we know not that much about this first person essayist. But on the other hand, I think there is a real sense of becoming companionable with her mind kind of meandering. And it makes me think of these are essays kind of in errancy, which is to say there's a kind of real meandering, wandering quality to them, which is a virtue and I think a real weakness in many places. But the book made me think quite a lot about a novel in short stories that you may or may not have read that came out last year called Pond by Claire Louise Bennett, which I reviewed for The Times because, that book, in a similar way, you get to have this sense of real intimacy with this woman who's slightly eccentric. And of course, it's short stories, so it's a fictionalized persona. But there's a similar sense of intimacy with both of these female persona, first persons, and they're both somewhat unusual. They're both somewhat not quite what you expect them to be. And that's what I really liked about this book. What Katie has heard me say is that I just found it insanely frustrating to read because I do think she is talented and up to something interesting. I thought there was just like very little control over it. And I was shocked in some places by how little control there was, given how good certain segments were. And part of my shock was kind of the shock of an editor, actually. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, it's remarkable that FSD published this without a little more editing, because some of the sentences literally just don't make any sense. I mean, they just don't syntactically work. They're just not good sentences. I mean, they're not even not good sentences. There are a lot of bad sentences, but there are sentences that literally just don't track. And, again, to give her credit or to sort of acknowledge what she's up to, she is working. She's working a very unusual style. She's working a kind of expansive, periodic sentence that is kind of questing toward meaning as it progresses. So there's a lot of clauses. But there were times where I was just so frustrated. Jacob, I loved your metaphor of this, but it was like eating a lot of oysters with not enough pearls, and I thought, wow, it would have been such a different experience, or like opening the oysters and there was no oyster, And so I just thought, wow, like with a little more work, a little more discipline, this would have been such a different experience. And I think, maybe it's probably that I'm here in my guise as someone teaching nonfiction writing that I was like feeling especially frustrated. I was like, wait, this could have been such a strong book. And I think instead it's a very up and down book. Anyway, that's my rant.
I like your description of its sort of peripatetic eccentricity. There's a phrase that Katie and I were talking about this morning. And here, this is literally – it's not even a phrase. It's just a piece of a sentence that I'm pulling out without any context. But where she speaks of – she says – call something this parish of miscellany. I think it's the stuff on her friend's table or something like this. I don't recall the exact moment right now. But there is a way in which there's a kind of gathering here. It's like she's constantly building these shrines. But to what end? It's not always clear. So, you know –
She's a bit of a magpie.
She is,
She collects shiny objects. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes shiny sentences.
Yeah, and I love a lot of her observations. I do think when we talk about what makes her quirky or eccentric, like, it's her eye, you know? It's the way that – it's an association. It's a description as opposed to necessarily an insight. Like, I think that she – it's funny because she has very beautiful descriptions and yet the sort of the ideas, like the conceptual scoops, as you might say at Slate, the observations that she makes are pretty, I wouldn't say eccentric, you know, like Nook people, the sort of the collection right. of things that we're supposed to identify with as Nook people if we are, felt not boilerplate, but, you know, oh, you like enclosed spaces, you like hot tea.
I wonder if it's worth backing up and just because that is such a striking phrase of hers, the Nook people thing, Katie.
Yeah. So is it in Heart Hotel?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. She talks about being like this sort of type of creature that is a Nook person, and she names herself one of these people who sort of gravitate towards, and I'm not sure if she says this. Well, explicitly towards Nooks, towards enclosed spaces and being comforted and kind of enclosed and immersed.
She writes, "I don't require much to feel far removed, to impose my wanderings on what's close. Because of this, my friend and I have started calling ourselves Nook people, those of us who seek corners and bays in order to redeploy our hearts and not break the mood, those of us who retreat in order to cubicle our flame, who collect sea glass, who value a deep pants pocket." I mean, in some ways, this does describe a lot of what this collection of essays is doing, gathering things, magpie-like, as you said. And in other ways, it's just sort of a description of any vaguely inwardly turning person who is a writer or fancies himself a writer who would potentially be reading a collection of essays published by FSG. I mean, it's hard to imagine a reader for this book who would not say, oh, yes, I'm a Nook person too.
I don't want to cubicle my flame.
Whatever what that flame. Means.
Although I must say I do love the way that she uses unexpected verbs. Like she talks about pedestaling these older white girls. And I love cubicle my flame, pedestal these women. Anyway, but yeah, no, I agree. And I think that something also intrinsic to this Nook person characterization is a kind of self-voyeurship. I'm not sure if that's a word she actually uses if she talks about like self-voyeurism. I think she might. But she's constantly sort of she's examining herself in this kind of like not delighted because that sounds smug or, you know, not self-delighted, but she takes a lot of pleasure in looking and she is often looking inward. And I guess one quibble that I ended up having with the book is I'm not sure that there was enough. I mean, it's not like she needed to be kidnapped by pirates or something, but, you know, what she found when she looked inward were these sort of moments of wonder. Like I left the theater and I felt so sort of swept aloft and a part of me was kind of like, good for you. You know, feeling wonder is a great thing, but, you know, I think I wanted more of a sense of stakes or tragedy. Sorry, go ahead, Megan.
Yeah. No, can I jump in? Well, no, I'm so you both are saying such interesting things, and I have a question for us all, but before I get to the question, I guess absolutely. I mean, I think that I'm laughing because the book made me feel very old. I felt like I just was like, yeah, okay, like I get it, but like, come on, you know what I mean? Which is, I'm being harsher than I am, than I mean to be, because I really, let me put it this way: I would love to read her next book. I think part of my frustration was that I was like, okay, I think you could be a really good essayist. You're kind of letting yourself off easy. Like, there's just not enough work put into these. And part of it has to do with the actual structure and writing of the pieces and how long they go on and how, you know, she's going for this meandering thing. But again, you have to have discipline to that structure, right? You want the structure to kind of find its form, whatever that form is. And it feels like the form isn't here yet. And then, yeah, I had that response where I thought, oh, kind of like you were thinking, like, okay, good for you. Like, she starts the essay about going to the movies in the summer, which I like, but she starts by being like, I call them the movies. I don't say I'm going to a movie. And I'm like, yeah, we all do. Like, I don't know. It's not that interesting. Sorry.
It's funny.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, it's funny that you would, you speak of her letting herself off easily. There's a bit near the end of Heart Hospital, the enormous, expansive essay of the collection, which I think both shows her promise as an essayist, but also exhibits many of the things that one might find frustrating about it. She says, how being hard on myself is oddly a lazy system for letting myself off the hook. Mm. Which do you think she's doing? Is she letting herself off the hook?
I think she does both. And I think that's what's quite – that's why I kind of circled back. I reread a few of them and I came to – I think I was so driven crazy by the lack of control over her language that it was hard for me to enjoy what she was doing when she was doing it. I was jet-lagged and annoyed. And then I reread the book when I was less jet-lagged and more patient. And I didn't reread the first essay because that was the one I had the most trouble with. And I found much more to enjoy in it. And I think that what's quite interesting about her, and one reason I would pick up her next book, is that there is something there. There's some aesthetic there that's complex and kind of paradoxical and very literary, but kind of contemporary. Perhaps because I was in Paris, I was also thinking about Proust, though she's not like Proust in many ways, but one way she is that she's very interested in interior solitary experience of the mundane, mm-hmm. right? And of what that kind of interior experience feels like. So she's an essay about living alone that, you know, I thought was spotty, but had some nice moments. But she's an essay about things she cannot unhear that I thought had a lot of really interesting moments in it. That is just, you know, these little moments in a life and then how they end up constellating, how these dots end up becoming a constellation that accrues to some larger meaning that is not, you know, can't be like normatized or regularized for other people, but that we all have our own. There were moments like that where I thought she, in getting into some very real particulars, in that piece, she talks about falling from a rope bridge in Copper Canyon in Mexico. Let me just find it. And she writes about the sound that she made while she fell. And I thought that was just incredibly haunting. Let's see if I can find it. She says, but what comes to mind most from that day is the sound that slipped from my mouth as my foot fell through the plank. It's hardly a sound and mostly a breath, a gasp that was cut short as if sliced by a butcher's knife. It sounds something like, huh, like the laziest reaction, like a giving into an agreement, sort of. I can never unhear that gasp. It wasn't the sound of my life flashing before me. It was the very human understanding that gravity was real and that I was about to fall and that nothing was going to catch me. I mean, that's really good, you know? But I guess what I wanted to ask you both was, and because I think if I were her editor, partly this is what I would ask her too, is, you know, well, a broader question for us, I think that's interesting is, you know, what do we think essays can accomplish? Like what is an essay up to? An essay is kind of a strange form. And I guess this goes back to Katie's question about what's at stake here. And I was trying to grapple with like, what's she really up to? Like, what is she really trying to do in these pieces in this and with the essay as a form, let's say, because I had sort of different answers at different points, and I was just curious what you both thought.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Jacob and I are both exchanging glances like, you go. No, you go. what's curious to me is that the words that are occurring to me are words that I normally associate with poetry. Like, I was thinking, you were talking about one of the sort of appealing aspects of her mind being this kind of humility, and she dwells in the mundane. And it reminded me of Marianne Moore mm-hmm. talking about humility mm-hmm. and concentration mm-hmm. and gusto. And I think she's got the gusto yeah. down. Yeah. Like she absolutely,
yeah.
there's like a real sort of delight. Again, it's the magpie kind of gleeful yeah. collection impulse.
Yeah.
And I think that concentration is there in a sort of not in the sense of rigor or discipline necessarily,
right.
but
right.
in how hard you have to work to sort of take off the shells of these sentences. She describes writing as a closed pistachio nut, and I think like there is a lot of signification in each sentence, but you have to work at it, and the payoff I think can often be really great, but it's not easy to read this book, I don't think. Maybe you guys had a different experience.
But sometimes that's because of a style that's a successful style, and sometimes that's because of bad sentences.
Hmm.
You know, that's my theory. But
anyway. I mean, you say, what is the essay for? And I don't know if this is a normative answer, but it's the answer that comes to me in relationship to this book, which is that the essays – This attempt to tarry with a certain paradox, with on the one hand this deep intimacy with yourself, with your own preoccupations, with the things that fascinate you in ways that, in theory at least, they don't fascinate anyone else. And on the other hand, it's this attempt to reach out, to achieve some kind of recognition, some kind of acknowledgement from a reader. No one writes a good essay for themselves alone, but they always write it of themselves, whether or not it is a personal essay. And
that's a beautiful answer, Jacob.
Well, yeah. I think
no, it's
that,
really helpful.
I think that the best moments in this book are the ones that dwell in that paradoxical space. My experience of Heart Hotel in particular, I think, was very different than yours. I read it not jet lagged, but on an airplane on my way to a tiki convention in Florida, and I kept crying in my middle seat. You know, conscious of the fact that I was surrounded by other people, not because the essay as a whole made sense to me. It didn't really, and even at the end, when she comes around to the Heart Museum instead of the Heart Hospital, I was struck by it, but I didn't quite understand what I had read. And that, I don't know whether that's my fault or the essay's own. Instead, it was these glimmering, striking, sudden moments of self-recognition that would come up in single clauses or sentences or occasionally paragraphs. One passage that Katie and I had talked about a week or two ago was one where, just sort of in an offhand way, she says something about how, you know, her heart doesn't stop or doesn't overquicken or whatever it is, even when the ATM machine accidentally shows you your balance. and that,
right.
Which I'm sure is an experience that so many people have, but I've never seen put to words before, the panic of knowing how much money you have in your bank account when you've been trying to avoid thinking about that. I mean, it's been a long time since I was young and in New York and in my 20s, but that was what it was like to be 22, 23 in New York in my 20s was this this terror of ATM machines. Every
and
time
her
you
self-deprecation,
pull that
$20. It should be said. I mean, some of the best moments, I think, in the book are very self-deprecating. She also has this image of, I knew it was time to leave the wedding when I was making a drunken circuit between the dance – or among the dance floor, the bar, and other guests' uneaten slices of wedding cake. And I just thought that was the most delightful description.
That was a lovely sentence. That was a great moment.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
There are moments where I didn't recognize the experience she was describing, but I still found something exciting and stimulating in it. I mean, one of the, you know, the one kind of striking bit is when she's talking about Sharon Stone, and she says it's not her uncrossing her legs, but shoulders accelerating her pulse, shoulders that make her say, whoa. And that moment of inverting a common object of fetishism, of finding something else, of focusing on her own detail was fascinating and showed me something about her mind that wasn't the shape of her personhood, just something about a pair of eyes watching the world.
It's interesting. I mean, I definitely think, you know, I'm thinking of the, you know, if we think of the form, you know, one origin of the form being Michel Montaigne's essays and the idea of an essay as an attempt, right? That's what I think it meant in French. It's an attempt. This, you know, in that sense, these really are essays, right? I mean, they're kind of forays into consciousness and into, as you were saying, Jacob, fascinations that are one's own, but perhaps not others, and the attempt that, in the hope that in rendering them, one comes to understand more about oneself and also to, as you say, connect with the reader. I think I wish that what I would say about this book is it has really stayed with me. So that is, for me, always a sign of a real sensibility, you know, and I think that is fully formed. I think her sensibility is fully formed. I don't feel, partly because her sensibility is so particular, one wishes the style was as controlled as the sensibility is formed. I think that's part of what was going on for me. And, you know, to give an example of that, there were moments where she would have a really lovely sequence. She likes little litanies. That's one of her techniques. And she likes to rove. And the roving, you know, is a mode that can work really well. But I kept thinking of the term Roland Barthes had, the punctum. Have you guys come across this?
Yeah.
It's an idea he had about like the part of the photograph that makes the whole kind of intense.
Would be Sharon Stone's shoulders for her. In some ways.
Right. But I felt like sometimes the essay kind of lost its punctum in its kind of willingness to put everything down. And sometimes I thought, no. Now is where you cut that paragraph.
Right.
You know, and you let us sit with the image and you go to the next. And I'm looking for examples of where, you know, I want to find it. But yeah, I can't find the example I'm thinking of. But for every wonderful sentence, I'll read a sentence that I thought kind of just gets overwritten and sort of belabored. So for example, in Part of a Greater Pattern, which had some just truly wonderful writing about identity. And as you were saying about the kind of clocking brownness and her relationship to these white girls she grew up around. I mean, some of that was just so wonderful. But then sometimes there are sentences that I'm so in the writing. She's describing watching older girls ready to go out. And I just love the scene. And then it just loses me because the sentence says, because she's talking about watching the girls, you know, part their hair and do their makeup, because observing any woman smudge shiny powder down her brow bone to her cheekbone or flutter blink her lashes between strokes of mascara or delicately part her lips when lining her eyes, those rapidly precise, tidy, messy, and poured over motions, those closest to catching a glimpse of her acquiring the world with quiet enormity from that faraway planet, her mirror. I don't know. It just starts to. That's actually not a good example because that sentence is okay, but it just starts to get so labored. Like on the previous page, for example, she has this thing about girls kind of taking their scarves off, and she says, delivering their long necks from circuits of wool scarf was as ever a sight to behold, and sight is S-I-T-E. And I was like, is that a pun or is it supposed to be S-I-G-H-T? But all those little like as evers and there's a lot of these like then and now, and those are the moments I was like, you don't need to say like as ever. It kind of makes you sound like so profound.
Yeah, actually, I have a name for this little tick. I called her Little Mermaidisms because she will often have like a thing where she'll say sentence, can you believe it? adjective or like sentence. And I'm still working this out. And they're like separated by M dashes. And then there will be like a single word on the other end of the M dash. And it's like in the Ariel Part of Your World song, where she's, what do you call them? Legs. And I felt like she did that a lot.
I was like, why is it Little Mermaid? I never saw the movie.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, she has this, the mermaid has a song where she's sort of, acclimating herself to the vocabulary of the of the land lovers, and so she has all these objects, and she'll be singing about them, and then she'll say, "What do you call it? Fork, or like a fork, or something." And it's sort of like this word is so pregnant with meaning because you have a little setup to it, and I just felt like she did that all the time, in the essay.
Yeah. Which is too bad because it's such a delicate concoction. Her paragraphs, her in, you know. You kind of settle into this watching that she does, and it's so when it's good, she's, as Jacob was saying, she kind of describes these moments or scenes or feelings that we've all had. I mean, it made me think a little bit too about like Karl Ove Knausgård, who's not stylistically, but just in the sense that part of what people were responding to in those novels, I think, was a sense of very ordinary moments being described that we've all experienced of, you know, divided attention, you know, worrying about climate change while cleaning the dishes and talking on the phone, right? And there's something very modern or contemporary about the kind of multiplicity of these feelings and these kind of little observations you're making in your head while doing things. And I feel like she does that also very well, but I wanted to be suspended in her voice and mind. And I kept getting pushed back out a little bit.
You know, I wrote an essay a while back about Knausgård where I described the experience of reading those bits that you describe as feeling a little bit like drowning. I felt swallowed up by them. Here, she sort of sends the reader like a stone skipping across the surface of the water instead. You know there's an ocean beneath you, but you don't get to sink into it. And I wonder if I wanted that more or less. I don't know, actually.
It's weird because you're talking about it in terms of depth. And my quibbles are sort of in my head, I'm framing them in terms of shape. So it's not that it doesn't go deep enough. To me, it's just like these when it wasn't working, it felt the essays felt shapeless. And that's why I really appreciated the shorter ones, because I guess shapelessness is more frustrating when it's a very big shape or big something. So Moby Dick, for instance, I thought was beautiful. I wonder if we could even just like pick a few of these short essays to talk about more closely.
Sure.
I mean, first of all, did you guys – I think, Megan, you said you liked Moby Dick as well, right?
I did like Moby Dick.
This is the one that's sort of about reconciling yourself to the fact that you're going to be very, very bored by a lot of reading. we see her in the library. She's procrastinated, which also kind of plays a thematic role in this collection, is the idea of procrastination, and sort of like the spaces in between writing and productivity, like what is happening there, what kind of gestation or germination is happening. But anyway, after procrastinating, she winds up in her college library and she is trying to plow through Moby Dick, and she finds it immensely unpleasurable, and she keeps longing for distractions. And then she sort of, again, it's like plunging through the planks of the bridge. She kind of falls off a bridge into this description of the baby whales who are it. I guess one has its umbilical cord attached to the mother whale, and she just appreciates. She lingers on this lovely image, and then suddenly she snaps out of it and realizes that there at her feet is a cord, just a coiled cord.
An extension or lamp cord or something.
Yeah. And the last sentence is, the library will soon close for the night. Someone, what do you make of that?
I loved
this one.
Yeah, I do too. This one I didn't leave an impression on me in the first pass, but hearing you describe it now, and looking at it, my own open book here, one of the things that I found, I found myself underlining a lot of passages or highlighting a lot of passages as I was reading about writing, but I actually in general, I find people's descriptions of their writing processes very boring. and while her phrases were sometimes striking, you know, descriptions of writing as this kind of, you know, glorious excess where you lose yourself, there's actually like the internality of reading in it seems much more in keeping with the general tone of the book than any description of writing does. That feeling of losing yourself in a description when you've been putting off the act of reading and you finally really get into it is glorious.
Yeah. But, you know, I think to her credit, and one thing that with my reservations about the book that I felt very strongly the entire time and should underscore here is that I think she's up to something that's hard to do. You know, I think that used the word internality, Jacob, and that made me think of, you know, she's very interested in these kind of internalities, these states, these kind of aqueous states of the mind. But not in a, at her best, not in like a portentous or heavy-handed way. I mean, that's sort of what's nice about it is sort of the contemporary lightness of tone and preoccupation with the everyday, but then this kind of solitary, you know, internal, slow, you know, these don't feel like essays that were like published on the internet, actually, in a lot of ways. You know, they have this kind of restless slowness, which is part, and you know, wordiness, mm-hmm. which maybe in a way is a virtue given that sort of impulse to have everything come to its point that we, of the world we live in. What I loved about this essay and what I think works really well about it is that I do think this, Katie, you were talking about shape being one of your reservations, you know, that the sort of pieces feeling shapeless. And that is one of my primary reservations, both shape of sentences and shape of the essays, because I do think that while an essay can meander, it's these kinds of essays are quite like poems in a way, in the sense that a poem really is made by its structure and by its style. And she's juxtaposing a lot in very interesting ways. And also, I think, like a poem, casting a kind of spell where we're drawn out of our transactional mind, both our transactional mind and our transactional use of language, where I say, how much does the sandwich cost, right? And into a meditative language, an experience that's almost kind of rhythmic. And so, you know, you want those shapes to really work. And in this essay, you know, I thought, we see what happens when she can really control her shape. And it's small. It's not the most ambitious piece. It's not the most striking moment, you know, a piece of writing in the book in some ways, but it's kind of a very successful It's a machine,
yeah.
You know, it's a contraption. It's an aesthetic contraption that was very pleasing. And I thought that's what I've been looking for from her, you know, which again is why I'm very interested in her next work. And again, and not even that this is my favorite insights in the book or anything like that, but just there's a kind of confidence and authority and achievement in the writing that I thought really, and the use of quotation and just, it's really lovely, yeah. Really lovely just description of a kind of reverie that we've all been in where you're almost like looking at something without looking at it and then your eyes focus on it and you see what it is and it's strangely resonant. It's quite beautiful.
There's a through line, an umbilical cord that that connects mm-hmm. one paragraph to the next in this essay that we don't necessarily see in a lot of the others. And sometimes I like to think of a good essay as a kind of crystalline object where even if one paragraph doesn't clearly connect with the next, they all hold together in this highly faceted shape.
Yeah.
And in the book as a whole, this book as a whole, I don't see a lot of those crystalline objects. I just see a lot of diamonds scattered on the floor before me. And I want to scoop them up. I want to gather them together. But I also did sometimes want them in the way that this Moby Dick essay is, this short little essay is. I wanted them to come together into something more complete.
Yeah. I mean, a few things that struck me about this essay that made it different from the others, aside from the questions of length that we've already talked about and consistency, is I think she does a really great job of balancing ambiguity with the sense of determinacy. Like everything feels as though it had to happen that way. And yet when you see the cord at her feet, to me that was – I didn't really know what to make of that. But is it a letdown? Is it this is such a bereft image compared to like the mysterious, beautiful – subterranean whale scene, or is this, is there like a continuity between these two chords? And I mean, the chord itself is such a potent symbol too for an essayist who's trying to connect to someone else and whose thoughts are kind of traveling along a thread of connection, kind of like beads or like nutrients along a chord to the mind of the reader. And so there's a lot more design, which I guess is what you guys have been saying, is that you could feel that this was a tightly controlled essay, as opposed to someone falling off a bridge and being exhilarated.
Well, here we also see, though, what her observational eye can do with the ordinary. You know, we have Melville describing this astonishing scene that of a kind that so few people will ever see. I've been reading a lot about narwhals recently for something I'm working on, and just the narwhal stuff. really realizing how remarkable a scene of baleen life can be, if that's the right word. But here there's something almost as remarkable in her description of the chord itself. I finish the chapter and look up from my page, and then down at the library's carpet beneath my feet, and there, coiled and dragging, is a chord, lengths of it looping and alive, winding, tangled. The janitor has started vacuuming. I mean, there's some way in which that's that punctum that we were maybe missing in some of the other essays, that Bardian figure, the remarkable detail. I mean, Bart is talking in the essay you're alluding to, book you're alluding to, about photographs and about the eccentric detail that pulls you in, even if it's not the center point of the thing. There's no world in which a vacuum cord is ordinarily the center of any image of any life, but here it
might
becomes
be pulling
that.
Something in, but it's dust bunnies.
Here the incidental object becomes the important one, and that's a pretty glorious act, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I think that, and I may have appropriated Barthes for my own, sort of sense of something that happens in writing, although I think this is part of what he means, that, you know, that it's not just the detail that pulls you in, but also the detail, the way that a moment or the way that a detail within a shape, makes everything kind of constellate in a centripetal or centrifugal way that's quite satisfying and intense, right? Mm-hmm. And that's part of that dynamic that, you know, there are many of these interesting moments, but that kind of dynamic of the relationship between the paragraph, the moment, the insight, the mood, and the shape, right? That becomes a very vibrating and dynamic thing. You know, happens here, and it doesn't always happen. It happens in places, but not always. I quite liked the last essay too. I don't know whether you liked that one too. At my least and most aware. I mean, the end of it, I thought, had some really beautiful. Maybe it's really the end of it that I liked, where she's talking about what are the movements of a home. I just thought that last paragraph. So there are paragraphs that I just, you know, I starred and thought this is something really special is happening here. Mm-hmm.
That essay also had one of my favorite paragraphs in the book, you know, which is something that could almost as easily belong in that essay about things you can't unhear, where she says it still comes as a shock to me how irreversible life is, how there's no going back to whatever version of me existed before I saw that movie, the kind that switches me on to new streaks of consciousness by showing me a woman I feel strangely formally acquainted with. That discovery of yourself in the detail, in the sudden shift, in the unlikely discovery of something other than yourself is pretty cool when it happens. Doesn't always happen, but when it does, it's a wonderful thing to spotlight and to
I'm going to push back and be the Philistine here who I find that kind of revelation. I mean, when you guys talk about it, it seems very potent, but to me, it feels cheesy, and it feels like the exact kind of revelation that personal essays are precision tuned to deliver, and you expect it 5 minutes before it comes, and then it comes, and you check off the box, and then read the next essay. That's too harsh, and I really do admire her a lot, and I do find a lot to love in these essays, but I also think that the prevailing tone is this kind of tristful. That was like the perfect word that I stumbled on by accident because it was in my inbox. But this wistful and tristful and quizzical and whimsical, all these words that sound the same and kind of mean the same. Yep. It's just like a little bit of melancholy. And even when she describes, like, my sense of beauty is tinged with the perishable, that's a very old idea. That's Keats. That's I think a part of me kind of yearned for her frame of reference to be a little bit bigger. Like, one thing that I loved about the Moby Dick essay was she talked about, or maybe she was quoting Melville, but she said, the whale is curved like a Tartar's bow. And that was such a breath of fresh air for me because I was thinking, oh my gosh, a Tartar, archery. I wanted more of that. I mean, all these details and these comparisons and these words are sort of like peanut M&Ms and global warming and our moment. And I think I wanted more just like, I don't know, Norse gods or something, just like a little bit bigger frame of reference.
Yeah, I think, you know, and in that paragraph that, Jacob, you were quoting from, she has all these, you know, I talked about her using litanies and she has all these examples of like, you know, this is, it still comes as a shock to me how there's no going back to whatever version of me when I do this or this or this or this. Mm-hmm. And I agree, those, the list of examples, it goes on for a long time. And it's like, okay, it feels, that's part of what I mean when I say I started to feel old, because I was wondering what I felt much more charitably toward this as a 28-year-old or 29-year-old Megan. You know, I don't know that I would have, but it's hard for me to separate out. Some of my impatience is, okay, I need to be getting something from this a little bit more. And that's part of what I think I was trying to get at earlier of feeling like she settles too quickly or doesn't work hard enough or isn't disciplined enough. And it's frustrating because I think what I find unusual about this book is there are flickers of what I think of as really true talent, and there are other parts that just seem so, the ear just seems so, and the structure seems so off to me that I think, wow, it's really strange. It's not strange that you would draft this, like that's what everyone's draft looks like, but it seems so odd to me that someone who has that ability to write this paragraph would publish the essay in this in this state. And I think she has a real kind of decision to make as a writer about, you know, how she, I think she, there's some kind of sort of discipline to the prose that needs to get pushed a bit more, or should be, given that she does have this talent. Because like you, Katie, there were just moments where I thought, wow, you know, I mean, it totally makes sense in a draft, but then wouldn't you kind of read it and bring us the new image or strain or tighten that sentence or kind of cut this section that feels a little, you know, self-indulgent would be one word for it.
You compared it to Claire Louise Bennett's Pond earlier, which is a novel, a work of fiction, but one that feels like autobiography at times. Did you find those same problems in her prose or structure?
Not as much. No, I actually think the whatever, I reviewed that book really positively. I really liked it. I thought one problem maybe, I thought she was very tight, that she really had rendered the pieces in a very taut and tight way. Maybe sometimes actually there was too much elision in those pieces, you know, that sort of, you might almost want her to kind of put more on the page. And maybe there, what maybe was there that's a little bit similar, one reservation I might have had about it was that the sort of olds that Katie was invoking, the whimsical, quizzical, you know, it's a little enchanted with its own, you know, aesthetic in a way that I actually found very persuasive because I thought the prose was very controlled for the most part in that book, in a way that I don't find it so much here. But it's a risk, right? The sort of risk of preciousness, which tonally I think that this book really does a good job of mostly skirting. It's not, but in other ways it doesn't skirt it, if that makes sense. I mean, tonally I was like, oh, I'm interested, but I sometimes thought, okay, maybe you could have more insight, more wisdom, more surprise. I don't know, something. I was sort of feeling like it wasn't quite always coalescing. What's that? Yeah.
I think one thing we haven't
gotten into much yet, although we touched on it a little at the beginning and have glanced by it throughout, are the various and varied ways that that she grapples with her own marginality, with ethnicity, with her status as a first generation resident of Canada and then the United States, with gender and so on. And I wonder if either of you have thoughts on the ways that those issues crop up here.
I mean, I thought those were some of the strongest parts of the book, actually. I thought she wrote really, really vividly, and I was really kind of just caught up in those, in the section, especially we touched on this earlier, but the section where I think it's called, I'm going to forget, Part of a Greater Pattern, mm-hmm. where she touches on different kinds of scrutiny and, as I was saying, sort of this watching these white girls and then kind of realizing her own relationship to them and her own difference from them and where she felt difference and where she didn't feel difference. That was really powerful. And I think her portraits of her parents, which is one of the ways she also talks about marginality, that was some of my favorite writing. Like, I loved reading her about her relationship to her parents. I thought that was really, it's hard to write about one's parents, right? And she did it she really turned them into characters. I had a sense of them, but she did it with this kind of, you got the sense of her love and also her kind of looking at them, the particularity of their relationship. I also thought she wrote about, with a few exceptions where I felt like some of the gender material felt familiar. I thought she wrote about being a woman and gender in a really, in her own way, that she made it her own. Although I thought the essay "The Girl" didn't come off. But Katie, what did you think?
I mean, I would agree with you that the essays, first of all, I think that Part of a Greater Pattern, I would have loved that essay to have just been a shorter essay about the white girls and her. There's all this stuff about a drowned squirrel in the pool. I wasn't really sure what to do with
work.
But I do agree with you that that was really wonderful material. She also has an essay, D as In, that talks about kind of the estrangement from yourself that you can experience when people call you the wrong name and sort of the strange process of realizing that it's not okay for people to call you the wrong name, which is, you know, something that she actually had to grow into, a realization that she grew into. And I thought that was I guess I wouldn't say that I thought the writing in those in D as In, which is the name of that essay, was better than the writing elsewhere. But I did feel as though there were more takeaways in, for instance, that essay and Upspeak, which is about her voice, her kind of feminine sounding light voice that makes people underestimate her, she said. Like, those were essays where, at least when I finished reading them, I knew what the essays had been about. And I appreciated that. So I actually think that.
There's a precision in many of these pieces to the quality of kind of observational insight D as In A, which you just alluded to, Katie. She has a bit, to be first generation means acquiescing to a lasting state of restlessness. It's as if you've inherited not just your family's not a DNA, but also the DNA acquired from their move, from veritable mileage, from the energy it took your parents to reestablish their lives. To me, at least, a striking and somewhat insightful phrase, but it's also one that starts to pull together some of the threads that may have seemed random or out of place, or at least not quite structurally coherent.
It's a thesis.
In essays like Part of a Greater Whole, where there we start to see why it's so important for her to talk about her parents in the way she does, because understanding their experience, their particularity is so central to making sense of her own complex and fraught place in the world, her own liminality, her own particularity.
No, and I thought that was an aspect of the book, sort of cast across the book as a whole, that was working. That, you know, that there's a sort of, intention there that's being made good on. I agree, Katie, that D as an A isn't, you know, necessarily the writing that's the most arresting in the book, but it feels important to what she's trying to talk about. I mean, one thing that's actually striking about the book is that even though this is clearly a big part of what she's thinking about is identity and marginality and being a child, first generation, there's a lot where that's not directly addressed, right? In many ways, she writes about it very indirectly, which is also really interesting. Mm-hmm. And part of her style is to kind of sidle up to things. And that quote you just read, I think we see part of where that is, the sort of acquiescence. It's almost like stylistically, she's also, you know, kind of saying, oh, okay, I'm going to come to this, but I'm not going to come frontally to it, which I thought was itself really a powerful evocation of something about her own experience mm-hmm. of identity in America and Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially in that kind of ambiguity can be self-protective when you don't feel like you have the privilege or the power to say something outright, that kind of sideways sidle, as you say. It can show that someone is in a less empowered or less autonomous position.
And also at the same time, it's insistent. One thing I really like about the book is it's insistent on its own individuality, right? So it's mm-hmm. I am a category. It's I am an individual, and these happen to be the characteristics of my individuality. And one of those characteristics is that other people categorize me, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a very strange, you know, experience. And I think she kind of, in this indirect way, really gets at that in ways that I really liked.
Yeah, one of my favorite moments in the book also is in D as in A. She talks about her discomfort with the first person singular pronoun, with the I of the first person, mm-hmm. Of the personal essay. She says, how can an I contain all of my many fragments and contradictions and all of me that is undiscovered? In some ways, the complex dance of negotiating this intersectional liminal identity that she lives has stylistic consequences for her. I think it speaks to some of the evasiveness that we see elsewhere in the book.
Well, this has been so lovely. Thank you guys for sharing your brilliant thoughts. And I honestly feel like the way you both speak about this book has been as rewarding and beautiful as reading the book, which is not to downplay the book.
I think it's a remarkable book, and I would encourage everyone listening to this who hasn't read it to give it a shot.
I'd say give it a try, you know, page through, see what you think. I think it's great, but I can understand why mileage may vary.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you both.
It was great to talk to you both.
Thank you. All right, bye. Thanks for listening. You'll find the show pages for this and every episode of the Audiobook Club at slate.com/ABC. And for more books, check out the homepage for the Slate Book Review at slate.com/books. Visit our Facebook page where you can leave a comment on this episode. That address is facebook.com/slateABC. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, which helps other people discover the show. Search for Slate Audiobook Club and don't forget to leave a review while you're there. It really helps other people discover the show. Slate's Audiobook Club is part of the Panoply Network. Find out more about all of our great podcasts at panoply.fm. And for other great podcasts, if you're looking for something else to listen to, I highly recommend The Gist with Mike Pesca. It's about politics, culture, news, anything that crosses his fevered and wonderful brain. And so please give The Gist with Mike Pesca a listen. You can find it at slate.com/thegist or wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch, and thanks for the assist, Dan Bloom. Slate's executive producer is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is our chief content officer. For Jacob Brogan and Megan O'Rourke, I'm Katie Waldman. Thanks for listening, and see you next month with Do Not Become Alarmed.